All right, I want to switch gears completely. I want to talk about what a chaotic system looks like. So we're now going on Scott's, and I'm grateful that we have it here. And I will see if I can resolve that. And the irony of this is I was trying to pull off all the recordings that we have of the baby. And unfortunately, it looks like there were disk errors, so I'm a little nervous about that. So I couldn't free up space. Hopefully, I will get that resolved one way or another. Chaos is a microkernel system. And what it means, what's a microkernel? Let's see, those of you who've done my OS course or any of my other courses have heard this before. So the idea of a microkernel in brief is to strip down your kernel so that anything that you can get out of the kernel with a reasonably clean abstraction boundary, you do get out of the kernel with a reasonably clean abstraction boundary. What people tend to leave out when they give that, and maybe even some things that are not so clean, but you can force them out. And the rationale is, look, the smaller you make it, the more likely you can get it right. And the cost of going wrong when you're running in the kernel is you get to see the advertisements from the BIOS vendor. I personally am very tired of those. I've seen a lot of them. So the less stuff you have running that's in a position to whack the machine, the better off you are. This is the view. And a lot of stuff that classically goes into a kernel absolutely does not need to be there. There are two things that the advocates of microkernels often fail to acknowledge as they're doing this description. So one is, well, when I'm done throwing out all the stuff that could be modularized, what's left? It's all the stuff that was very hard to modularize, right? It's a convoluted, exhaustively interdependent, non-divisible hunk of stuff. It has lots of self-interdependencies that are subtle, because if they weren't subtle, they would have been modular and you would have removed them. It is possible to write microkernels that are well structured. I hope we've done so, but I suppose we're going to find it. The good news is that a well structured microkernel is generally going to be in the range, depending on what we're talking about, of 4 to 15,000 lines of code. 4,000, what we're talking about, is something like the ignition controller in your car. It's not an operating system in the sense that we would normally think of. It probably does not implement multiple address spaces. It certainly doesn't implement much in the way of resource management. It's designed to take a fixed partition of resources and manage it. And there's a really important use for things like that. And when it's controlling my brakes, the smaller it gets, the happier I am. Remember that there's one bug for every 10 lines of code. Think about that the next time you hit your brakes. I'm serious. And we're building stuff on Coyotes that's going to go into medical equipment, and people's lives are going to ride on it, which frankly scares the hell out of me. If it doesn't, I should be doing this. We have stuff deploying in the field next year that's going to run the back office data centers and banks. You know, if I turn off the power in the data center, it really doesn't matter whether the computers are broken into or not. You have other stuff that's going to be going into major telephony installations. It is just not okay if this stuff crashes every 4 to 5 weeks. And just to calibrate this, right, when the 5ESS switching system was designed 20 years ago, the design goal was 5 minutes downtime in 25 years, including maintenance. And they met. The only exception to that objective that was actually seen in the field was due to a major fire in the Chicago switching center, which was beyond what they considered a software problem. I think fairly so. That's the level of reliability we're looking for here. And I will have to tell you, I think that Kyotos is at the outer limit of the complexity of a system that might be able to sustain that. And it's at 12,000 lines. Now, why is this 10,000, 12,000 line? I mean, you know, line, 10 lines is a fuzzy business, right? Where did you put the new lines in the middle of the statements? But the reason this is a magic number, in a certain sense, is that 10,000 lines is still within the limit where you can hold the entire system in your head at one time. And that is simply not possible for something the size of the Linux kernel. I do know 3 or 4 people who have enough mental stretch that they can do something the size of the Linux kernel, right? In the world. And none of them work on Linux, by the way, because their time is more valuable. So the good news, the bad news is, you know, what you have is a highly interdependent system. The good news is, it is something where you actually can keep track of the interdependencies. And one of the things that I hope you'll find, I think it's true, that Kyotos is very careful about is being very explicit about documenting what the interdependencies are and tracking them religiously. And part of that is because of the feature I'm going to tell you about in a minute. One of the things that happens when you take stuff out of the microkernel is you throw out a lot of function. You don't throw it out from the system, you throw it out from the microkernel. If you want it, you'll re-implement it as an application. For example, I don't know of any microkernel that, there are things labeled as microkernels for marketing reasons that aren't microkernels. Mock comes to mind. I don't know of anything that's actually a microkernel that implements a file system. There are some, I can make a case in both directions for whether bottom-level device drivers should go into a microkernel. They certainly shouldn't go into the core. There may be reasons for them to reside within the kernel address space. Linux strikes an interesting middle ground, right? If you actually look at the core of Linux, depending on whether you consider the network stack part of the core, it is very hard to chop that out. Linux is either about 125 or about 250,000 lines of core code. That's not counting modules. Right? And then the modules are mostly isolated subsystems that can be command loaded, and they have a clean and well-isolated, mostly, interface. So it's a very interesting middle position. Kyotos is trying to take a pure microkernel point of view. The other cost of that is there are cases where you want to manage data motion across multiple levels of abstraction. I am doing a file access. In the microkernel, I have to call the file server calls the disk driver manipulates the drive sends back data into the disk driver address space, the disk driver sends back data into the file system address space, the file system sends back data to me. That's a lot of copies. Copies are expensive. There are ways to mitigate the copy effect, but there is a cost to structure. Modularity that you then take out with a compiler often has very little cost. Modularity that's actually enforced in the real deployed system structure can have a cost. And Kyotos is not immune to that. But the cost of performance is part of the cost of 5 minutes downtime in 25 years. Yeah?
Can I ask a question about the functionality? So your argument is that by reducing the size of the kernel, you make it more dependable.
I'm sorry, I make it more...
Like, the way you make it more dependable.
By reducing the size of the kernel, make it more dependable, yes.
Right. But in doing so, do you reduce the functionality?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So
not of the system as a whole, but of the kernel.
Right. So what I'm trying to say is then, if you want to have a system which has that functionality, then that code has to go in the application layer. So to have the same amount of functionality, doesn't matter if it's a microkernel or not, because you still need the same amount of code. I mean, do you see what I'm
trying to say? So you're asking a very astute question, right? So the observation is, look, if I want to have a file system one way or another, I got to have the code for file system. I didn't make it go away by moving it from one place to another. Have I actually achieved anything here? The answer is yes, for two reasons. First, if the file system is not in the kernel, I may be able to architect the system in such a way that a failure of the file system is not a failure of the entire system. And that can be important. Second, if I build the right abstraction and modularity boundaries, I may end up with a significant reduction in overall code size. Even if I don't end up with a significant reduction in overall code size, I definitely end up with a significant reduction in the unpredictable interactions between code. When one piece of C code throws a wild pointer reference in your application, right, and the GTK library throws a traceback, you're naturally inclined to blame the GTK code. The error may have come 15 subsystems away. And the revelation of this error may be very much delayed, right? I threw a wild pointer error, it didn't touch me because it happened to hit a defined part of the address space, but I scrambled a data structure that 10 minutes later the GTK library hits. Good luck tracing that. Well, if those things are in separate address spaces, that wild pointer error is much more likely to hit the address space boundary than it is to hit GTK. So what I'm arguing is there is a place in the world for libraries, but libraries are things that I should introduce when I absolutely have compelling data that I cannot afford a real boundary of protection. Memcopy is not something I want to run in somebody else's address space. GTK might very well be. So we're arguing essentially that as each component gets smaller, two things happen. One is its errors become easier to find. Two, its dependencies become more explicit and more separately testable and isolated. So we're not arguing that code or function necessarily goes away. We're arguing that structure is your friend when you're looking for robustness. This argument, by the way, was argued very loudly, and the reaction from the OS community has been yawn, the research OS community. It's not a very exciting argument. It's a very hard thing to measure. And there's been an obsession in the research operating system world on quantitative measurement for quite some time. This obsession historically was a reaction to Mach, which suffered from a high bullshit quotient. And unfortunately, the cure for bullshit in research is measurement. And unfortunately, measurement is also the cure for architecture. Because you often can't measure qualitative effects using quantitative metrics. At least you can't measure them in any short time frame. There are predecessors to Kaelis, Eros before that, Kikos, that ran in the field for decades without interruption or compromise. The problem is it's anecdotal evidence. It's very hard to quantify that. It's very hard to wrap your head around it. And one of the strange things is when we talk to people who build embedded systems that really have to run, right, they get it. Right? They understand that structure and testability is something that they have to have. Because people get killed if they don't have it. And when you talk to computer scientists about this stuff, they don't get it at all. As a rule. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, on both sides. All right, so what does a Kaelis system look like? Kaelis by design, although not by current implementation, is a persistent system. And this turns out to color a lot of aspects of the system design. What do I mean by that? I mean that periodically, at established intervals, or when you push a button asking for it, the system pauses, and now I'm describing logical behavior, not implementation, copies the entire system image to the disk, and then continues. And it does this in a transactional way. So that if I yank the plug out of the wall and put it back in, and this has been done, in fact, it's been done in public, in front of thousands of witnesses, if I yank the plug out of the wall and put it back in, what the system does is it goes back to the last saved image, reloads it, and proceeds on from there. Now, if you have a laptop that has a hibernate mode, this doesn't sound very exciting, but there's a difference. Hibernate is simply a copy of the memory image with a very, very modest amount of cleanup, right? Your drivers are just barely, sometimes, smart enough to reinitialize the hardware when reloaded. That's not what's going on in the Kyoto system. What's going on in the Kyoto system is we're actually going through the object space and writing down the objects as objects. It's not merely a memory snapshot. We can take the snapshot, move it to a different piece of hardware, boot it, and it will work. It's also faster than the Hibernate system. So what doesn't come back? Basically, any connection that physically exits the machine that requires reauthentication will not be recovered. Why? Well, we don't know that the person at the other end of that terminal line is still the same person. Right? So we have to reauthenticate. Also, this process does not happen by stop and copy. If you've actually run Hibernate by hand on your laptop, you'll notice it takes a while. Some of that is that the operating system is scrambling to get out of its own way because it wasn't actually designed to do this. This was retrofitted. What happens in Kyoto is a bit different. When you say, take a snapshot of the system, a single bit is flipped and the snapshot is done. Well, kind of. What the single bit tells us is any object that has been modified now needs to be copied before we can modify it again. So basically we keep a red-black generation kind of thing, and if the object we're looking at is in the wrong generation and it's modified, we do a copy on the right.
So you're writing the disk every time an object gets changed?
Oh, good God, no.
Okay.
No, no, what happens is the system runs for a while. What we need, okay, logically what we need to do is we need to basically say, okay, let's take all the modified objects and let's freeze them so that we can write them down, okay? And then we'll allow execution to continue, but we need to hang on to these copies until we've got them written down. So if somebody needs to modify one of these objects that we froze, when they go to reference the object, what we'll do is we'll make another copy, a new copy of the object. We'll write down the old one and we'll allow them to continue with the new one.
So how did you, when you pulled the plug in the demo?
This has nothing to do with pulling the plug. What I'm describing here is how we capture the snapshot.
Oh, okay.
I'll get to the plug.
Okay.
Meanwhile, in the background, we write the snapshot down. We write it down to a log area. It's very much like a database system. It really is a transaction in the database system. We can get the entire snapshot written down and make a mark that says, yes, there is now a new snapshot and it's complete. Okay, so when the plug is pulled, we simply go to the disk and say, let's find the most recent complete snapshot. And we will reload it and simply resume execution from there, exactly as if execution had never been interrupted at that point, except for this issue of external connections. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Now this running, I'll get there. This writing down is done in the background, right? It's done using this copy and write mechanism, and it's done in this lazy fashion, so it doesn't tend to interrupt your active use of the machine. There is sort of a scramble as the first few objects get copied, because of course, the first thing you're going to do immediately after a snapshot is going to try to run a process. The process is going to be something you were running before. That's been modified, you need to copy it. You see the picture. In practice, what we observe is only about 25% of memory on a modern machine is modified at the time of a snapshot. So we've actually got lots of places to put the copy pretty quickly. Okay, had a question over in the corner.
So what do you do about file systems?
I'm going to get there. In fact, I was going to get there next. Okay. So in this kind of a system, you don't tend to see a file system as a primitive mechanism. In fact, you don't even tend to see files as primitive mechanisms. What you do is the other way around. Right? In a Unix system, the way you build a process is you load a bunch of files into the address space and you start running code. In a Kyoto system, the way you build a file is you execute a process that implements the behavior of a file system. Now, I'm sure that makes a lot of sense. This is a real head twister. Okay? Let me try this a different way. Let me talk about how a Kyoto system starts up. What's in that snapshot? Think of it as a set of tables, right? There's a table of process structures. There's a table of pages. There's a table of mapping structures, which we call GPTs. There's some other objects. Those tables capture the state of a running system. They record that state. The first time the system powered up, there was a table like this. That table was hand-constructed by a set of system generation utilities. In much the way that in an embedded system you write a ROM image that has all the code the system should run when it starts up, it's very much like that. So the system starts up from this initial system image, and it starts modifying objects. And it comes to a point where it says, hey, good, now's a good time to write things down. And it writes a new system image, and it proceeds in this fashion increment. Now, why was this approach chosen in the architecture? Well, two reasons. First, if you're actually building an embedded system, this is actually kind of convenient because you don't have to muck with all the extra stuff that goes with having a file system that you don't need. But the more important reason originally was a security argument. If you want to understand what the security state of the system is, and whether the system is now in a secure state, you find that you have to make an induction argument. And the induction argument goes, somewhere in the past, I had an initial state that I have some confidence was secure by construction. Right? This state was the start of the world. We're doing Genesis chapter 0. And I have a set of rules that say, here's an operation, and if this operation is applied to a correct state, it produces a correct state. Does it smell like induction to you? So if I want to argue that some state of the system that I'm now in is secure, there are two approaches I can take. I can freeze the system and attempt to do, you know, a God's eye view and analyze the state of the system and hope I understand what's going on, which, by the way, I never do. Or I can argue that I know, because of the way the system is built, that this thing has to be right because it's an inductive result of a series of correctness-preserving transformations, namely the system calls. Well, actually, the instructions as well. So if you want to understand that the system is secure, this kind of inductive argument is a very important thing to be able to build. I'm talking here about maybe even verifying the security properties of the system, at least some. And we've actually done this verification for Kyoto's. Well, excuse me. We've done a verification very close to this for Kyoto's predecessor, and we haven't changed any properties in Kyoto's that would alter the outcome. What does secure mean? Secure means I have a well-defined policy that I can articulate formally, and I can show you that the induction was preserved with respect to this policy. Well, one of the things in particular that this approach lets you dodge is a problem in the security world called the startup problem. When a hardware machine powers up, it powers up in supervisor mode, it can do anything. And by the time you run application code, you would really like to have reduced that authority down to something manageable. You certainly don't want the application code able to do absolutely anything. It is very, very hard to show that you have given up power in a computational system. So in the Unix case, for example, Unix spawns a NIC. If you know something about the internals of Unix, you can find a place where it spawns a NIC. And if you were to try to convince yourself that init does not have all of the authority of the kernel, and if you were trying to kind of make the argument rigorous, you would discover it was extremely hard. In fact, and it does have damn near all the power of the kernel because it runs the supervisor mode. And then init's going to start other processes, and those processes are actually often fairly powerful. And somewhere down the road, we're going to get to your shell. And somewhere between the kernel starting init and your shell typing hello, or whatever it is your prompt is this week, we're going to drop a lot of authority, we hope. Try to prove that you did it, and you'll discover that the argument that you did this successfully is a very complicated argument. It is at least as complicated as the argument that having dropped the authority, you then maintained it correctly. So the original reason that this design choice of persistence went into the Kiko system, which was the origin result, and actually the Gnosis system, which was before that, is it is much easier to argue, huh, I had a good state before, and I have it again, and I'm just going to run this, and I don't have to downgrade anything. That's just a matter of establishing that I got back the bits that I put out. It's a much easier argument to sustain than that I successfully dropped the authority. So that was why it went in. But it turns out it has really nice consequences, because my programs get to assume that they run forever, barring mishap. Furthermore, they get to assume that if I have two processes that are in communication with each other, that they agree about what they've said to each other at all times. Right? So in particular, A is talking to B, they're going back and forth, they're sending messages, the system crashes. In many systems, if you were able to recover the processes, right, there are checkpointing systems that operate one process at a time. But having recovered the processes then have to talk to each other and say, okay, A says, well, I think I sent you message X. Did you get that one? B says, no, I don't remember getting that one. Worse, right? A says, I think the last message I sent you was message number 10. B says, uh-oh, the last message I got was message number 11. And not only that, I don't know what that message held. And by the way, I've already done the operation that message told me to do. This is the distributed transaction problem. The best way to resolve the problem of a distributed transaction is not to have a distributed transaction. They're very, very hard to roll back. And this sort of thing, now imagine that we're going to do it across all 1,000 of the programs that were running in the system at the time that we crashed, each of which was checkpointing away without regard to the rest of the program. Now, we're going to hit the same problem in Coyotes, but we're going to hit it at the machine boundary. My machine is going to snapshot independent of your machine. The difference is that at the machine boundary, there are other possible sources of failure where we're going to have to ask synchronization questions. If I drop a network connection, there is inherently the question, well, did you get the last message I sent? What have you done about it? So the difference is, in the first case, it's extra work to deal with the problem. In the cross-machine case, it's a problem we had to deal with already. And it's a problem that rarely comes up, because the vast majority of program interactions are local. So how do I get a file system? Well, basically, I build a program that has a very large memory space, right? And it says, good, your file is from here to there. And when you ask for this byte range of your file, I'm going to do a memory copy back to your process from my process. Does that sort of answer your question, at least as a starting point?
Sure.
Kind of.
Well, so what I was more wondering, there's a kind of a problem like Unix hosts with file systems where you snapshot the kernel, and of course you have, you know, dirty data up in cache, and you can't presume the image, right?
Right.
So. Now you have to run phase.
But we're not snapshotting the kernel. We're snapshotting the entire system.
Right. Sure.
Okay.
But you also can snapshot user program so on. But your file system state is now spread across what's actually on the platter and what's in your resume image.
Right.
So it seems that if you had a file system process that had issued requests out to disk, that even though you are, sure, you're snapshotting the file system process and the disk driver, but you are not also translatively snapshotting the object store on platter, that would be correct.
Well, yeah, we are actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because the snapshot is basically defined as the object store on the platter plus the delta consisting of those objects that we've modified. So main memory in this system is modeled as a cache. It's a write-back cache, so we're going to work with an object, a process. Object here is in the sense of an operating system object, a process, a page, something like that. We want to modify an object, we want to read an object. We load it into the cache, which is to say we pull it into main memory. We go ahead and do the operation on it. Before we modify the object, we mark it dirty. At snapshot time, we freeze those dirty objects. And so it's always the case, somewhere here I have Chuck, it's always the case that there's a base image and ignoring the initial system condition where the deltas are all going to be empty, it's always the case that I have a base system, I have the last delta that was completely snapshotted and written down, okay, and I have a current delta that I'm in the process of building that I either have not yet taken the snapshot on or have not yet written it. In fact, there may be one more. So, delta 1 is written to persistent media, disk. Right. Delta 1 is snapshot, but write in progress, or incomplete. Delta 2 is the next snapshot we're going to build. We're still in the process of constructing the state of that snapshot. We haven't declared a snapshot. And there's a sequence of these deltas. Of course, if we actually implemented it this way, we'd soon run out of space. Yes, only 25% of your memory is modified at each delta. That's still a fair bit of stuff. So now what happens is, once we have a delta that's fully captured, we then do what's called a migrate, and simply take these versions of the objects and overwrite the old versions of the objects in place. Now, if I'm looking for an object, suppose I am looking for an object whose object ID is 10. Well, I'm going to check. Basically, I'm going to proceed in this direction until I find it. The most recent delta that has it, that's the one I'm going to get it from. And it turns out that the migrate is also transactional. When I am done successfully migrating this delta, I will mark the fact that I am done. And at that point, I can actually drop the delta itself, because it's all been moved.
So you said that you will pull an object out of the last delta.
No, the most recent.
The most recent, right? The most recent one which exists. You mean the most recent complete delta?
No.
So then you're writing things out in the dependency order?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, that's a good question. Depends on who's asking. If I'm running a program, right, if I'm the program running, I want the most recent, most currently modified version of my page.
Sure.
Right? If I'm the transaction management system, right, what I want is the most recent snapshot version of the page. So yes, there is a subtlety to handle the transaction management that we might ignore most recent delta.
There's not a danger that during the migrate process, power goes out or something?
Good question. Of course there is. But it's not a danger. Okay. Why? Because it's done transactionally. We do a transactional marker when the migrate is done. Suppose the power goes out. We're halfway through the migrate. We've written half an object. Well, we'll power the system back up. this delta still exists, right? The rule is you pull the object from the most recent delta, which means the read will happen from here, which is still a good copy. And we will simply restart the migrate. We'll probably do some copies that were already completed, but we don't know which ones are which, and we'll resolve it after the power resumes. And the net effect of this is that programs run until they're destroyed, as opposed to until the machine fails. Or until they incur an error. Boy, this leads to a very different way of thinking about your program. First, you're a little more concerned about errors. Right? But second, there's a lot of sort of reconstructing infrastructure for large systems that you can structure in a completely different way. Once you get all the pieces assembled, you can mostly rely on them to remain assembled. This snapshot and checkpoint mechanism is not present in the current Kyoto's code base. So if you go looking for it, it's not there. It's in our queue to get it implemented, it's just not done yet. We know how to do it, we've done it in the previous generations. But if you're asking, hey, how's that done? I'm afraid you're not going to find it today. Quite possibly by the end of the semester, you will, yes.
I have a question about the snapshots.
Yeah.
So if these are objects, so it is a page, suppose the object of the page that has to be written back.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I change a bit in that object,
right. So
I have to write the entire object back. That is what I want to
write.
There is no difference between, you don't take the delta is not a difference between the base object and the current copy.
No. The delta is between the base state of the system and then a set of objects that have been modified since then. And there's a long, so, downside of this, we're going to write a lot of state that's going to die very soon, namely much of the state on your stack. Right? You're modifying your stack all the time. If we don't crash, right, we're going to write down some of those pages, we're never going to look at them again, because you will have modified them again by the time the next snapshot comes around. So potentially a lot more data might get written here than in a conventional system. In practice, and it's a long, subtle, tricky set of arguments and measurements, it turns out it's a wash from a performance perspective. And the reason is all of the writes to the transactional log area are sequential and linear. And the thing that's expensive about writes up to a threshold is not the amount of data you're moving, but whether you have to do seeks to do the writes. So our seek ratio on write is an order of magnitude lower than a conventional system. Also, notice that this stuff went to the log, right, which was a very dense area of the disk that was written in linear form. This stuff got scattered to hell and gone across all the disk drives you had, but it was a bulk block I/O activity. So one of the things that we could do is say, oh, before we start any writes, why don't we look at all the things we have to write and sort them so that we can write them in disk order? This also drives the seek ratio down. If you've looked at log structured file systems, you get a similar effect. The difference is, in a log structured file system, the only locality you get is temporal locality. In a classic file system, what you fight for is spatial locality. In this system, you get temporal locality in the log followed by spatial locality in the base. So it's a hybrid system, if you want to do it from that perspective. Although actually, the design predates the log structured file system by 15 years. Okay, what does this mean to me as a programmer? Well, it means that what I'm mainly concerned about is not building files. What I'm mainly concerned about is setting up processes and address spaces and the connections between them. Okay. So, there's a window system running in a process somewhere, and it has access to the frame buffer. And I want to build, a program that's going to run my desktop. Well, that program needs a connection to the window system. In some sense, that program runs whether my machine is turned on or not. My machine is turned off. It surely does run very slowly. And it has, not only are the processes persistent, but the connections between the processes are persistent. So in this system, that connection is not a network connection. It's something called a capability. Capability is a kernel, in this case, kernel protected primitive, that names an object, in this case, the Windows system process, and it names an interface that that object implements. And if I hold this capability, I have the authority to invoke any method of that interface on that object that the capability names. This is a fancy way of saying we're going to do a remote procedure call. But in contrast to something like a CORBA system, where the descriptor that I have is really just a network connection, and all of the procedure call stuff is layered on top of that in the application. Right? In this case, the descriptor is logically to an actual object, not to a server. So I've drawn this picture indirectly. I'm just going to move the desktop to the left here. There's an intervening object. When I annotate arrows with these little key symbols, it means I'm trying to describe a capability, not just a pointer. And for historical reasons, we used to refer to capabilities as keys, because capability is a cumbersome word. What's this object in the middle? This object is an endpoint. Why do I care? Well, if I send a message by invoking this capability that points to the endpoint, this capability, by the way, is called an entry capability. All the pieces of what I'm describing here are in the reference manual, reference specification that you got handed earlier. If I invoke that entry capability, what's going to happen is the kernel is going to look at the endpoint and say, let me find the process that this message is supposed to go to. How do I find it? There's a process capability inside the endpoint object. What is that process going to get? Well, I supplied some arguments to my invocation. The receiver is going to get those. It's going to get two other things in addition. It's going to get the endpoint ID of the endpoint. What's that? It's a number. It's just a 64-bit quantity that was previously installed there by the receiver. The kernel imposes no semantics on this. Its interpretation is left entirely to the receiver. The receiver is free to ignore it entirely. The usual use is it's used as an object ID. So if I have a server, like something, a process that's implementing a file system, this will be the number of the specific file. This is how I'll know which file you're using. Inside the entry capability, there's a smaller field. The endpoint ID is 64 bits. The PP field is 32 bits. Called the protected payload. So PP is protected payload. And EPID is endpoint ID. Both of these numbers are numbers that the sender cannot control, modify, examine, or do anything else to. So if I'm a server and I receive a message from the kernel on behalf of the client, that message has an endpoint ID in it. That endpoint ID did not come from the client. It came from a data structure that I previously initialized, which means I'm enabled to believe it. I don't have to worry about whether the client forged that identifier. Similarly, the protected payload is not something that comes from the client. Basically, as the message traverses this chain of arrows, the kernel picks these values up and shoves them into the message in predetermined places. So the convention is that I'll use the endpoint ID as an object ID, I'll use the protected payload for permissions, and I'll let it dispatch. I'll dispatch in the endpoint ID to say, well, okay, I implemented 4 billion objects. Which one did you just invoke? Aha. I'll use the endpoint ID to look that up. Are you authorized to do the operation you just asked for? Well, if I implement any kind of complicated permission scheme, I'll use the protected payload value to tell me that. So to make that concrete, there's a kind of an object, and you'll discover quickly that we use object and server as very flexibly interchangeable terms, in our system called a space bank. It's responsible for allocating storage. You need a new page of storage, you go to the space bank and you ask for one. Excuse me, you go to a space bank and you ask for one. I'll get there. And there are read-only space banks, and there are other constraints on space banks. So I invoke a capability that I believe is a space bank capability. What does that mean? It means it behaves as if it were a space bank. There is actually a mechanism to determine whether it's a for real space bank or not. But without invoking that mechanism, I don't know that. I just know it does space bank behavior. And I say, I need a page. And the space bank says, well, okay, but you know, that's nice, but are you entitled to have a page? And there are two criteria. One, is your quota permitted? Two, does this capability of the space bank authorize you to make allocations? There are read-only space banks. And the read-only bit lives in here. It turns out all of the space banks in the system are implemented by one process. So the thing that identifies your particular bank is the endpoint ID. So getting back to the file system, right? I probably have one endpoint per inode equivalent, right? This becomes the equivalent of my inode structure. Actually, not quite true. This really is a placeholder box that holds my inode number, and the actual inode structure is probably going to live inside the server because I'm going to need a bunch of data that's recorded in there. Okay, you had a question.
So, if a capability is dispatched, does the server get a reference to the client? Or does it only get the arguments passed and the protected payload and the ID?
Depends on what the client sent. Good. So really what you're asking is, what's the payload look like? And there are lots of variants on this theme in different microkernels. We're just about to wrap up. But the short answer is, up to 8 data words of immediate value. It turns out most invocations involve only small arguments and they go in registers. And up to 64 kilobyte string that is optional. And up to 4 capabilities. You want to reply, you better send me a capability that lets me talk back to you.
So also just thinking from a file system perspective though, right? If I have an endpoint that I'm using as an inode entry, there can be several clients that have the authority to read that inode, but if I don't get an identifier or who's asking a question.
Good. What you're leading up to is the question of, well, what about principal IDs? How do I do permission decisions based on who's asking? The answer is, and I'm speaking now mathematically, in principle, you can't. And I mean, in the Unix system, you also can't.
Right.
At best, you know what process, the process that made the immediate request, right? Who did it allege that request was for? You don't know that it wasn't proxying, right? There are a lot of issues here. So two issues. One, a permission system based on false axioms isn't a permission system, it's a delusion. Two, if you want to achieve that, and for example, we can emulate a Unix system in this, right? You're gonna have to go to other mechanisms, and in particular, you're gonna have to implement, using the mechanisms of the microkernel, essentially a containment boundary around users. And there's nothing to stop you from saying, well, I will allow multiple endpoint IDs to map to the same object, and I'll use, in some sense, think of that as giving me some extra bits. And I'll use those extra bits to record this. Right? Or I'll have a Unix server that knows about principal IDs, and it'll do the right thing. Okay? So you can construct these idioms, but they're not primitively provided. So the model of this kind of system is basically, I'm going to start processes, I'm going to grant them the capabilities that they need to do their jobs. Hopefully I'm not going to grant them any more. And once they have them, they're going to keep running until I whack them. And they're able to build further processes, and they're able to delegate the authority that they have, bypassing or providing capabilities to those processes. And this system, capabilities are the only primitive mechanism for describing permission. So think of it as a graph evolution exercise, but the only way the graph can evolve, the only way I can give you a capability you didn't already have, is if I have a capability that authorizes me to talk to you. So the way Martin Miller puts it is connectivity begets connectivity. Here again, when you go back to the inductive property, right, we're going to use this to let us make certain kinds of security arguments. All right, since we are basically at the end, for next time, I've handed you a gob of material. The specification is not, like all specifications, it's dense. It's also a work in progress. You remember the scheduler chapter, which it summarizes too. We need to define how the scheduler works. What I would ask you to do is read through the two shorter documents that I handed out. The code that I handed out is for you to be able to look at while you're reading them. You might actually be better to do it online. Probably not tonight, but tomorrow we'll have the actual line number linkage working. The specification is something that you should maybe make a cut at, but don't worry about getting every jot and tittle. Believe me, we're going to hit them in gory detail. I want you to have it as a reference to fall back to, but also I want you to have it to see if you can have a place to go to resolve terms. You're going to have two surprises as you try to get your head around this system. One, there are no threads in this system, no kernel threads. It is possible in this system to have an address space that is not associated with the process. Address spaces are first class. In fact, a file, if you think about it, is merely an address space. It's a degenerate kind that doesn't have per page permissions. Two, the thread abstraction basically is a kernel scheduled unit of execution, which in our lingo would be a process, that names some address space that defines what its memory references mean. What it means to have two threads share an address space is you have two kernel scheduled units of execution that are resolving their references through the same address space. Great, we can do that. We have two processes. They both name the same address space. How? They both have in common the same top-level address space capability. So this whole process thread notion is a holy war among operating system designers. If you're looking for how the threads work, don't ask where the threads went. Ask, given the primitives, could I build the thread abstraction? And the answer I believe you will find is yes. All right, two. You're going to wonder where the memory mapping primitive went. It ain't there. In this system, there's nothing like MMAP. The system behaves, conceptually, much more like a hardware mapping table in that there is an explicit mapping structure, the page table. And if you want to build a map, what you do is you assemble pages and page tables in the appropriate way according to the definition of how the translation algorithm works. Right? So essentially, you define the data structures that the translation algorithm then traverses. In this system, the page tables are called GPTs. GPTs stand for guarded page tables. And the way you assemble an address space is you assemble a tree of GPTs, or a lattice, actually, because you can have things mapped multiple. And the leaf entries are page capabilities. Now, if you dig into GPTs, I urge you not to try to figure out how the guards work the first time through. The guards are there to allow you to short circuit parts of the graph where you basically could drop things. The way to think about them is they allow you to optimize the graph. So when you're trying to work out how GPTs work, build the simple, obvious hierarchy, and then ask, how could I reduce the hierarchy? The thing that you'll observe when you build one of these graphs, very often you'll discover that there's a GPT where only one entry in the GPT is actually used. All the others are invalid. That's the case where the guard comes into play. If you're trying to get an intuition about the guard, build the obvious table, then try to take pieces out by reworking what your guards are. like I said, I certainly don't expect anybody to come in next Tuesday having memorized the specification. In fact, I sincerely hope that by the end of the semester, you still have not memorized the specification. Waste of brain cells. But please do use it as a reference. Please try to gloss it. What I want you to come back with is not mastery of the specification, but complete bewilderment about what the specification is saying in place of X, Y, or Z, which you'll hopefully ask about. Okay? Because this is kind of like looking at a bunch of Legos when what you're after is how the skyscraper is constructed. Right? We're going to build a skyscraper out of these Legos. The dots from here to there are not always obvious. Okay. Any questions before we go? I am setting up a machine that will be available for anybody to use for projects and such. You're welcome to use your own machines. Instructions for how to get a copy of the Coyotes tree, I hope functional instructions are actually in those documents. I've asked Neve to put up tools on the general machines. I don't know if you'll have time to do so. In the past, our experience has been, frankly, you're better off working on the class machine. Office hours. Scott, you probably haven't had a chance to think about office hours since you had all of 2 hours notice that you were TAing. Could you think about that? Yes. I will get an mailing list assembled. My office hours, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to make them by appointment. I am very happy to come in and talk to people. I'm happy to talk by phone. I actually enjoy doing this goofy stuff. Okay, so please don't hesitate. But the best thing to do is drop me an email and say, hey, I'd like to know. And I'm very, very happy to do that. And then before you go, there's always somebody whose legibility is impaired. My God. And there's always an exception to every always. Mr. MacArthur, you're marginal, but okay. I can hang around a little bit for questions, and I'm very happy to do so. However, I would ask, in the interest of clearing the classroom, because I don't know what's coming next, my office is 212, which is down one staircase and around a corner. So if you have questions, come on by all means, but let's do them there. Thank you all. And I really mean it, because you're pretty brave to take on a three-hour lecture. If I do not